This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Getting struck by lightning has become a reference for a statistical rarity. It's like winning the lottery or being attacked by a shark. The chances are almost impossibly slim. In truth, lightning strikes are far more common than you might imagine. More than 500 Americans are struck each year. And in an 80-year lifespan, the chances of being hit at some point are about 1 in 6,000.
A chiropractor and L.A. County lifeguard was in the ocean when a massive bolt of lightning struck Venice Beach on July 27th.
My heart, my lungs, everything probably stopped working the second that bolt of lightning hit.
There are certain elements we hear in just about every survivor's story. The bright flash, the 911 call, the charred clothes or blown off shoes. What we don't hear is what happens in the months and years afterwards. In a recent article for Outside Magazine, science writer Farris Jaber explores just how little we know about how lightning strikes affect the human body and the symptoms that survivors may experience long after the storm has passed. Farris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Farris, you start your article with the story of Michael Utley. Can you tell us what happened to him and how his story kind of defies our common thinking about the lightning strike survivor?
So Michael Utley was struck by lightning on a golf course in May of 2000, and he received a direct strike probably to his head, and enough electricity got inside his body to stop his heart and lungs. So he was actually technically medically dead for a little while, but the friends that were with him rushed to his aid, gave him CPR, and they were able to restart his heart in the ambulance, so he did survive. But he sort of was in and out of a coma-like state for more than a month, around 38 days. And after that, he had to spend a long time in rehabilitation, relearning how to walk, how to talk, how to swallow. And ever since then, he's sort of had this lifetime of chronic physical and psychological problems. He still has a really hard time walking and getting around. You know, when he tries to move from one place to another, he sort of shuffles. He says he looks like a drunk. He still has a lot of pain in his muscles. And it changed his personality as well. He says it made him a lot meaner, a lot more irritable. He thinks that the personality changes contributed to his divorce. So it really sort of, you know, he says that it really aged him many decades in a single instant.
There are videos on Outside's website, conversations with some of the survivors. Here is Michael Utley talking about how people really don't understand his long-term symptoms after the strike.
The wounds that you see will be, if you're wearing a necklace, that'll heat up and it'll burn your neck. So, you know, there's no entry, there's no exit wounds. People look at you, hey, you look fine. You know, but it's like you pour a Coca-Cola on a laptop. You can clean the laptop up, really. Looks good. It's going to run the same? Probably not.
A necklace heats up on his neck. Do doctors know what actually happens to a person's body when they are struck by lightning? And how might that compare to other electrical shocks and injuries?
Yeah, so there are some things that doctors and scientists know, and there's a lot more that they don't know. So what physicists know about, you know, when a lightning strike hits the human body is that most of the electricity actually passes over the human body rather than right through it, which is why a lot of people who are hit actually survive. So, and they call this a flashover. So if you think about the way that lightning strikes a tree, you know, both people and trees have this soup of water and minerals inside them that is a really good conductor of electricity. But when lightning hits a tree, it's forced to go straight through that tree because bark is so tough and inelastic that it has to stay inside the trunk. But with human skin, which is much more pliant and soft, electricity is able to pass over it. So it crackles around the skin rather than going straight through. But when it does pass over the skin, it can superheat any metal objects that someone is wearing, like necklace or jewelry or a zipper, and then that can burn skin. And it can also turn, you know, moisture and rainwater and sweat into scalding steam. And that's what blows people's socks and shoes off, and that can also burn the skin.
You mentioned they're not often fatal. How often are they?
So 90% of people who are struck survive. And 10% of people who are struck die. But the 90% of people who survive have these really chronic and mysterious physical and psychological injuries.
Yeah, no surprise, a number of physical injuries. But about these injuries that we cannot see, neurological or emotional after effects, what do we know about those?
They're really wide-ranging, really diverse, and really difficult to explain. They include everything from insomnia to memory problems, personality changes, forgetting, you know, how to use everyday objects like a potato peeler, a sort of constant ringing in the ears. Some people find themselves with something like narcolepsy, where they just get really exhausted all the time. And, you know, there's really only a very small number of doctors that have seriously looked into how exactly these psychological changes come about. And the evidence suggests that the electricity in a lightning bolt essentially fries or ravages the nervous system and parts of the brain. But, you know, one problem a lot of survivors encounter is that they go from doctor to doctor, from psychiatrist to psychiatrist, looking for somebody who knows how to help them. And they have a really hard time finding anyone, because most medical doctors don't receive training on how to treat the long-term symptoms and after effects of a lightning strike.
Here's one of the victims who is profiled in your piece. It's Phil Broskovac. He was struck while mountain climbing in 2005. And he's talking here about an experience he went through about a year later.
I think a year or two after the strike, I was in the grocery store. Last thing I had to do was go get produce. And I'm walking down the produce aisle thinking nothing. Everything's fine. And then they go to water their vegetables. And before they do, they make little lights flash and they make thunder sounds. And then they spray the water. And I freaked out completely. I pushed the metal cart as far away as me. I mean, I went crashing into some vegetable bin. And I went down into the lightning pose, which is balls of feet, hands over your ears, as small as you can be with your mouth open. And there was no lightning strike. So that when I finally looked around, I was looking at all these people staring at me like they were watching a person have a complete and utter breakdown, which they had.
Sounds to me like symptoms we've heard from traumatic brain injury or PTSD. What kinds of resources or support systems are available for survivors trying to deal with emotional symptoms after a strike?
So there are a few annual meetings of lightning strike survivors and also people who have survived electrical accidents. And a lot of lightning strike survivors have turned to these meetings because they found so little support in the mainstream medical community. And usually they get together and they share stories. And a lot of people say it's very, very helpful, especially in the beginning when, you know, a lot of their family and friends even just have a really hard time understanding why and how they've changed. So it's really helpful for them to commiserate with each other and just know there's other people out there that are going through the same thing.
Well, you attended one of these conferences in Lynchburg, Virginia, met a lot of different kind of people. We have heard about a sort of fringy side of population who have been struck by lightning as having special powers. Did you meet any people like that?
Yeah, I went to a lightning strike survivors conference in Virginia, and I did meet a few people who had stories that were a little harder to believe and a little bit more difficult to check out. And I think that perhaps these conferences attract people who, for whatever reasons, are just sort of seeking a community or seeking commiseration, and they might exaggerate or make up certain parts of their stories. But it's also possible they don't realize that they're doing it. You know, it's possible they actually believe this has happened to them, even if it hasn't. And yes, you know, there are people who claim, for example, that when they walk past the lampposts go out, or that now that they've been struck by lightning, they think that they're statistically more likely to be struck again, or that, you know, batteries never last as long with them as they do with other people. And I guess, you know, it's somewhat understandable why something like this could cause such beliefs. But, you know, most scientists and doctors don't think there's any evidence for those kinds of phenomena.
Farris Chaper, thank you for a look at a population we just don't hear about. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's science writer Farris Chaper. You can find a link to read his article, The Body Electric, for Outside Magazine at wordofmouthradio.org. Those videos of survivor testimonials are there as well. If you want Apple's latest, the iPhone 6 Plus, you can expect to shell out $300 or more. While that may seem steep, some are spending upwards of $30,000 for customized cell phones with concierge service. The newest thing in conspicuous consumption when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Apple revealed its new iWatch last month, it also offered an 18-karat gold option. Tech sources estimate that the cost for such a device would be in the neighborhood of $1,200. If paying that amount for a watch made by a computer company gives you pause, imagine paying nearly $10,000 for a cell phone. Enter the Aster, a new offering from the high-end phone company Vertu, created specifically for women. Before you take out a loan to buy one, you may want to hear what our next guest has to say. Gabriel Roth is a novelist and freelance writer. He took the Aster for a test drive at one of Vertu's upscale boutiques and wrote about the phone for Fast Company. Gabriel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the price range for this phone?
Well, the low end of the Aster is $6,900. The most expensive of the basic models costs $9,700. And then if you want to get a customized or personalized version, they wouldn't give me a top end. So I think we can assume it's pretty high.
So what makes this phone so expensive?
In terms of the components and the hardware, there's nothing especially surprising about this phone. It's exactly the same sort of thing you would get from a high-end iPhone or Android phone. It's a touchscreen device. It runs the Android operating system. It'll be a very nice phone, but there's nothing to make it 10 times as expensive as a top-of-the-line iPhone. What makes it stand apart? Number one, it's upholstered in extremely expensive kinds of leather, which are made from ostrich or snake or calfskin, in fashionable colors that are designed to appeal to contemporary tastes. But I think more to the point, what makes it stand apart is this is an attempt to apply luxury branding of the kind of thing that we see in the apparel or handbag industries to cell phones, so that in the same way that a Louis Vuitton purse might cost $5,000, even though the materials might cost only a fraction of that, this is a cell phone that's designed and priced along the same lines.
Well, I can imagine test driving a $300,000 Bentley would be a very different experience from test driving a $15,000 Toyota Yaris, right? It's going to reveal some differences in performance and handling and comfort. Would I notice a difference between my iPhone 6 and the Aster?
Not in the same way as a Bentley, certainly. You might notice that it feels pleasingly heavy in your hands. The sides are gently beveled to accommodate your fingertips. The screen is maybe a little brighter, and it's certainly bigger. It's in between an iPhone 6 and a 6 Plus. But the thing about a cell phone is the controls, the buttons, are all part of the software. They're all part of the touchscreen. And so the feel of using it in your hands isn't going to differ from using an iPhone or a regular Android phone all that much. That's just outside of Vertu's control.
Well, I can imagine maybe, you know, buying a really expensive Philippe Patek watch or something like that so I could hand it on to my child or something like that. Now, these Vertu phones are supposed to be handcrafted by an individual craftsman. Wouldn't I rather have some techie in the Silicon Valley who does this all year design my phone?
Well, first of all, we need to differentiate between designing and assembling it. These phones are designed by technological designers, same as any other phone. But you know what these craftsmen are doing replaces the work that's done by an assembly line of workers in China at a plant like Foxconn, rather than having one person install one component and then pass it on down the line to the next one in the industrial process that's been with us since the days of Henry Ford. Vertu phones are made, each one is put together by a single person. The idea, I suppose, is that it gives it a sort of handcrafted feeling, but it's not clear to me how the result would be any different.
You also found that there's an added bonus of 6 months of complimentary concierge service, which is kind of like a live human being of Siri, you know, booking your plane tickets and getting restaurant reservations, which did strike me as odd. If one's wealthy enough to buy this phone, are you going to trust a phone company to be your personal assistant?
I think that's a really good question. I think most of the buyers of this phone aren't actually going to be using that service as much as one might imagine or as much as you or I would if we were to have a personal assistant available on call.
So who's the market for this? The Russian oligarchs, you know, the Kardashians? Are people actually buying them?
there were earlier Vertu models that seemed to be targeted more at that demographic. They had more a sort of louder, more blinged out look. There were jewels all over them and things like that. These ones have a more refined appearance, and they seem to be for the same sort of consumers who buy those expensive purses and those expensive watches and want other people to notice, but not to think that they're gauche or obvious, to think, oh, this is a person who really has expensive, lovely, classy things. I don't know if the cell phone market is really a place where those people are going to go to purchase those kinds of luxury items. But Vertu is doing very well, and I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing other manufacturers start appealing to that same demographic pretty soon.
Did it work on you, Gabriel? I mean, did you walk into the boutique and, you know, like buying a Gucci bag for a lot of money, get individualized attention and a sense that the salesperson was a greater human being than yourself?
It didn't have that effect on me, no. And I'm sort of immune to the allure of those luxury brands. It's not something that I particularly covet. And so I walked in and out of there feeling like the whole thing was pretty ridiculous. But I also walked out of there feeling like, well, this is the way economics is going. This is the way the American market is going. There are more and more obscenely wealthy people who have enough money to spend on things that don't really increase their quality of life at all. But what else are they going to spend all of that money on? Mm-hmm. And companies more and more are going to be producing products that are designed to appeal to them rather than producing products that might actually be an improvement on what came before. And I think that's kind of sad.
Gabriel Roth, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Author Gabriel Roth, not speaking to us on the Aster, by the way. His debut novel, The Unknowns, is now out in paperback. And we found his article, The Bentley of Cell Phones at Fast Company. If you'd like to check out some of these high-end cell phones, we've posted photos on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And from cell phones for the ultra-rich to cellular technology in the developing world. If you live in sub-Saharan Africa, your chances of getting a prescription for your pair of eyeglasses are next to impossible. There's only one optometrist for every 8 million people. But a smartphone can help, so says a professor at MIT. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber went there to check out the story.
Okay. Hi, I'm Ramesh Raskar. I'm associate professor at MIT Media Lab.
Raskar heads up a team that's developing a new way to measure eyesight.
2 billion people in the world have a refractive error.
Refractive error is a term for vision problems, anything from nearsightedness to astigmatism.
And according to WHO,
the World Health Organization,
about 500 million don't have access to eye care. And many of them are blind simply because they don't have access to optometrists and ophthalmologists who can prescribe them the right pair of glasses.
There are very few optometrists in the developing world. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's one for every 8 million people. And the machines used to diagnose eyesight problems are bulky and cost thousands of dollars. There are organizations out there that bring eyeglasses to the poor, but aid workers have to schlep around hundreds of pairs of glasses to try to accidentally find one that might work for someone. That's heavy, expensive, and it doesn't always work. But what if they could diagnose the problem and then provide the exact correct pair? What if they could do all this on a cell phone?
Can I try this? Can I see how it works?
I look through a small plastic eyepiece that's hooked onto a smartphone. Raskar's developed technology in the eyepiece that breaks up an image into 6 different parts and sends it to 6 different segments of my eye. But all I see through the eyepiece are some parallel lines on a cell phone screen.
And your task is to align the bottom of the green line with the top of the red line. And if you have normal vision, they would already look almost aligned.
Aligned like on top of each other?
On top of each other.
What do I need to do to try to make them line up?
As you're looking through this eyepiece, your task is to click on the keyboard of the cell phone till those lines are aligned. And the number of times you have to click indicates to us what your refractive error is.
I click a couple of times.
They're now touching each other.
Yeah.
But let's see if I can make them. Now they're on top of each other. So if I took 3 clicks to make them line up, what does that mean about my eyes?
A 3 click in this particular case would mean you have a refractive error of 0.9. It means anything beyond 1 meter is slightly blurred for you.
Interesting. Because nothing looks blurred for me.
Yet. Yikes, I thought my eyes were perfect. Raskar says maybe I needed to take a little more time before I started clicking. And anyway, he says that in the field, eye patients would do this test 8 times with the lines in different orientations to figure out just what's wrong with their eyes. And then a cell phone app computes exactly what eyeglass prescription each patient needs.
So we're already pretty close to what a high-end machine will give you.
This project couldn't have been done even, a couple years ago.
Today's cell phones have a resolution that's down to 30 micrometers. That's smaller than the width of a human hair.
And how does that help you?
It helps us in many ways. The resolution of your cell phone is directly proportional to the accuracy we can achieve.
So, to sum up just how simple this could be in the field, an aid worker would only have to be trained to explain to patients how to use the device. Everything else is done automatically. And then an aid group could bring the right prescription glasses to the people who need them.
When I talk to people who have worked in Peace Corps or have been overseas, they have told me that simply having a pair of glasses can completely change people's livelihood.
Raskar hopes to be able to change the lives of millions of people. Right now, the cost to add on the technology is a couple of dollars per phone, but he says when it's produced on a larger scale, it could come down to just a few cents. The device is being field tested and is already in use at an eye institute in India. Raskar says it could be widely available within only 6 months. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
Next up, word of mouth ventures into the bitter world of internet trolling and the role that race and gender play in online hate speech. A black woman goes undercover as a white man to take on the trolls. That's after the news from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether you think the internet is a great or a terrible place is partly a reflection of which parts you choose to visit. It's also a reflection of who you are and how people online react to you. Mickey Kendall is a writer who deals with an extraordinary amount of trolling and vitriol online. She's a black woman in real life, and she created an experiment to see how her online life would change if she were a white man. This story brought to us from On the Media's TLDR podcast.
So Alex and I were talking about the show recently, and we were talking about how the vision that we tend to have of the internet is a pretty optimistic one. Bad things happen, but people are mostly well-intentioned. But talking about the internet as a monolith doesn't actually make a lot of sense. Like, there are various internets within the internet. And a lot of times when people say the internet's terrible or the internet's wonderful, what they mean is their internet is terrible. Their internet is wonderful. The things that they choose to expose themselves to are good or bad. Part of that's not just what you're looking at, it's who you are. One of the reasons that Alex and I think the internet is generally a nice place is because we're white dudes, and the internet is not very terrible to white dudes. Mickey Kendall's a writer who writes a lot on the internet. She's also black and a woman, and her internet is wildly different from our internet. Not because of what she's choosing to look at or where she's choosing to go, but because people sling vitriol at her because they can look at her avatar and see her race and her gender. Every morning, Mickey wakes up, opens her phone, looks at Twitter, and just sees tweet after tweet of personal invective and vitriol hurled at her. This isn't, you're an idiot, or I disagree with your ideas. These are death threats and rape threats and threats against her family from people who just disagree with things she's written online.
When I open Twitter when I first wake up, because yes, I check Twitter like people check the morning paper, I admit it, I would have these really angry trolls, right? And they weren't just trolls. Some of them were people who, when you click through, were theoretically reasonable human beings, but not on the topic of the tweet they responded to.
A lot of people will tell you that if you're getting spam or abuse, to just block it out. She knows that. When she blocks it out, the trolls find a way around the blocks.
I also will have people who create new accounts because they'll have their account blocked and they'll just keep creating. There's a guy who's up to, I think, 40 plus accounts now. And that's all he does. He just keeps making a new account. He actually sticks a number on it. So I know where we are in this number of accounts. To tell me that if I were raped, I would deserve it and any one of a dozen other things.
A few months ago, one of Mickey's friends, a writer named Jamie Nesbitt Golden, tried an experiment where she changed her Twitter avatar so that it was the face of a white guy, just to see what would happen. And the results were so interesting that Mickey started this thing called the race swap experiment, where everybody was encouraged to change their race and gender online so that everybody got to see what it was like to experience the internet and the world as somebody other than themselves. So to understand how this unfolded, the best place to start is with Jamie's experience.
One of the things she kept talking about was how little trolling she got. People would either engage with her genuinely, or she just didn't get the comments in the first place.
Her avatar is a white dude, but she's still talking about the stuff that she's interested in. Like, the content is the same. It's just the face that she's slapping on it.
Yes, it's literally the exact same jokes, the exact same tweets about race, the exact same tweets about being a black woman. It was actually so ridiculous that she would talk about being a black woman and get responses from people who somehow decided she was a white guy.
What would people say then?
Oh, they would start, she would talk about, let's say she talks about abortion and abortion access and versus other aspects of reproductive health care and the focus. And you would get the same people who would be telling someone else that they knew was a black female in that conversation. You know, they were a terrible person, just wanted to have abortions, blah, blah, blah. They would approach her as though, here's a reasonable man talking about this problem. Let's really discuss these things with you. And would ask her why was it so important and what were the other factors and where was the evidence about this and all of these things. And it was bizarre to watch because she wasn't saying anything different.
I mean, that's insane. I feel like if I were in that situation, I would have two conflicting feelings. One is like, Jesus Christ, that's horrifying. And two is like that it would be almost be a relief. Like, everyone's always like, doesn't see this thing. Here's an example of this thing that literally you can change the face. The same words, totally different response. It's just so clear cut.
It was essentially when I tried it, I was talking about abortion. And this guy who came to tell me that abortion clinics were only in black neighborhoods and this and that and the other, like he and I've had interactions before. He was reasonable. He was calm. He was curious. You should remember my name since you've been in my mentions to troll me three times before now. But now you are looking at the stats from the Guttmacher Institute about where abortion clinics are and all of these things. And you just... I had no idea. I've always been told and blah, blah, blah. I have shown him that same information in the past with my real face. I still got the occasional angry comment, but none were gendered. None were racialized. It was actually more likely to be something like, oh, you're a jerk or you're an asshole, that kind of thing.
Was there any part of you that didn't want to go back?
Kind of. So it felt very strange to see someone else's face looking at me. But I'll be honest, I think I'm going to start rotating through flowers or cats or I don't know, something. Because one of the things that's really nice is not waking up to see 62 comments calling me everything but a child of God.
Part of the experiment was also white writers, like white male writers using avatars of like women or people of color, right?
Right. And so... there were a couple of people I know of who switched over, at least one of whom I think said they lasted about 2 hours.
Really?
And then, yeah. Well, he did it on more than one place. And so once it was on Twitter, and I think it was either Facebook or Tumblr, maybe Tumblr. And I'm trying to remember who it was because it wasn't someone I knew well, but I saw the retweet circulating around in the hashtag. And basically said, I've been called 14 names in like 2 hours. I don't know how you all do this.
Like, well, how do you do it? You just get used to it?
I have a very ornery disposition. We will put it that way. I refuse to be driven off the internet because they want me to be driven off the internet. You want me to be quiet just because you want that. Now I'm not going to give it to you. It has meant that I had to make some changes. I wrote about having to have a second trimester abortion procedure. And I wound up with a real stalker. And the far fringe pro-life crowd really harassing me. So I don't live where I used to live. And my last name on the bell and on the phone and things is not the last name that I write under. We moved not only back to Chicago, but very specifically into dense urban areas. Because when you live in the inner city, the chances of a white guy who wants to come shoot at you because you talk about abortion, drop.
Why is this? I guess I'm so literally privileged in that I get to – I don't have to worry. I don't have to think about my safety on the internet. I can put my phone number out. I can put my address out. It doesn't even occur to me. And because of that, I think I have an idea. I think the internet that I see is like an artificially nice internet. Like I think a lot of the ugliness is hidden from me. And it's not for you, but you also still choose to live a ton of your life online. Like why is it still worth it?
So, and this is the thing I think that people don't realize is that often when I am stopped on the street, I've been recognized on the street and I've been recognized at cons. Very young women of color and young white women too come up and they thank me for speaking. And the day they stop thanking me for speaking is probably the day I'll stop talking. But they are so happy someone is saying these things and talking about these things. And they maybe can't or won't be the one facing all of this noise. But I would rather the people yell at me than yell at them.
And that story came to us from the podcast TLDR and producers PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman. If you'd like to check out more episodes, you can visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. To have a strong online presence in the 21st century, women have to bravely face a slew of hate speak from internet trolls. In the ancient world, Amazon women had to brandish weapons to take on the Greeks and other invaders. Strong and fearless, the Amazons were a force to be reckoned with in Greek mythology. But did the fierce female warriors really exist? We'll find out after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the Iliad, Homer refers to the Antianeirae. It's a term that has been translated as women who go to war like men, or the equal of men. Those stories captivated the imaginations of the Greeks and the Romans. The women warriors came to be known as Amazons and were often portrayed as hypersexual man-eaters who severed off a breast to be better archers. Amazon myths have been repeated in artworks and stories stretching from the ancient world to American pop culture's Wonder Woman, Xena the Warrior Princess, and Katniss Everdeen of the Hunger Games fame. But were they real? For years, modern scholars dismissed Amazons as mythical figures, or perhaps beardless, bow-toting mongoloids mistaken for women. A new body of archaeological evidence suggests that the Amazons did exist. The Amazons, a new book by classic scholar, researcher, and author Adrian Mayer, finds the factual underpinnings of these legends and reveals in great detail the origins, lives, deaths, and legacy of these battle-hardened warriors. Adrian Mayer, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
One of the stories, and there are many in the book, is of Queen Penthesilea. And this story reveals so much about how Greeks regarded the Amazons, who fought against them during the Trojan Wars. Now, what is the story as handed down?
The story as we have it comes from many different fragments from a full epic about the Amazons. We know that there was a full epic about the appearance of the Amazons, and they were led by Queen Penthesilea. And she was said to be the most courageous of the Amazons. And the great champion, of course, of the Greeks was Achilles. And they actually fought a duel outside the walls of Troy, which just became one of the very favorite stories of the ancient Greeks. They talked about it a lot. Very popular on vase paintings and in sculptures.
And on vases painted to give people as wedding gifts. So what kind of message was given to the
amazing
happy couple?
You know, many people have, many scholars have suggested that perhaps the stories of the Amazons are so popular in antiquity, and they usually only think of the Greek males as telling and hearing and knowing about these stories. But actually, there were pictures of Amazons and Amazon armies all over public buildings, too. So they were wall paintings, great monumental sculptures inside the Parthenon in famous temples. Amazons were popular on pottery that was used by men and by women. And more than that, there are all these perfume jars that have survived. These are used by women exclusively for precious perfumes and oils. And they're decorated with Amazons in their fabulous outfits carrying their weapons. Ancient Greek girls played with Amazon dolls. I was just astounded when I went to the Louvre in Paris and saw their collection of terracotta dolls that were buried in little girls' graves. That means that little girls played with ancient Barbie dolls that were Amazons, and you could dress them, and their arms and legs moved.
So they were surrounded with these kind of images, playing with the dolls. When do we first hear of the Amazons in the ancient world?
The first face paintings of Amazons appeared just sort of suddenly out of nowhere in the 7th century B.C., and then they became incredibly popular in the 6th and 5th centuries. Now, the first written stories that we have about Amazons, it's really Herodotus, the Greek, who traveled to the Black Sea area and interviewed people, foreigners, Scythians, people who lived around the Black Sea and on the steppes that stretched all the way to Mongolia. And Herodotus interviewed them and found out all sorts of stories about their lives. They were horse-centered. They were nomads. They all wore the same clothes. The boys and girls were raised alike, and they went to war like the men. And then, of course, the archaeological evidence is just cannot be doubted now that there really were women who rode horses, shot bows and arrows, and went to war alongside the men, and that the Greeks knew about them.
Well, tell us about this, because, you know, for a long time, before DNA was used for archaeological evidence, if a set of bones was buried with weapons, it was thought to be male. What are some examples of the burials of people who are now discovered to be women and some of their injuries that support the idea that they were indeed warriors?
The most recent examples that I can think of, there was one grave in Thrace, now Bulgaria, with four skeletons buried with a whole arsenal of weapons. And these were assumed to be two warrior chieftains with their wives. And that was in 1975. But just a year or so ago, they did DNA testing and found out that all four of those skeletons were female. So that's one example. And one of the most recent examples, very exciting, just now breaking news, I got the press release yesterday. The archaeological team at Vergina, where Alexander the Great's family is buried, one of those graves contained one skeleton with a full set of armor and weapons, and the greaves are mismatched. They're not the same size. Well, this was assumed to be a male relative of Alexander the Great, but DNA testing has just shown that the skeleton belongs to a woman.
Wow.
And not only that, but the armor belongs to her because she had a broken leg from a horse riding accident, probably, and the mismatched greaves fit her legs perfectly.
Wow.
So that's exciting news.
That is indeed exciting. I mean, in your book, you sift through so much evidence to explain the drug habits, the dancing, the music, the trousers that Amazons wore, you know, all sorts of details about them. But I think we need to get to a couple of myths first. First and foremost, any evidence that Amazons severed off a breast to improve their skills as archers?
That is a piece of information that just has sticking power that you would not believe.
Well, there's a lot to it.
It's based on zero evidence, and it was an idea that was proposed because a Greek historian in antiquity was trying to figure out a Greek meaning for the foreign word Amazon. We don't know the origin of the word, but every scholar agrees it's not Greek. In antiquity, they tried to make it into a Greek word. So it sounded a little bit like amazos or amastos, which would mean without breast. So once you come up with that etymology, you have to make a story for it. Mm-hmm. So they made a story, and it just sticks like super glue. No one can shake this story, no matter how many times you argue against it. And people began arguing against it as soon as the argument was made. In the 5th century B.C. So ancient Greeks said, no, that can't be true. There is no evidence for such a thing.
Who were the Amazons, the fierce female archers on horseback of legends stretching from the ancients to Xena, the warrior princess, and beyond? For centuries, scholars regarded them as figures of myth. Adrian Mayer has sifted through centuries of artistic and archaeological evidence on the existence of Amazons, which is explored in great detail in her book, The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. How about families? If raised in these completely egalitarian, horse-centric societies, you know, always on the move, how did they raise children without the traditional structure of mothers in a protected nest?
The lifestyle was so different from the ordinary Greek lifestyle, and I think that's what really captured the attention of the ancient Greeks. They were just appalled and fascinated that women could choose to go to war along with men, or they could choose to go just a group of women only. This was just unheard of in Greece. But if you think about it, it's very logical for nomadic tribes. Small nomadic tribes, harsh landscape, harsh life, traveling back and forth such great distances. It makes a lot of sense that everyone in the tribe is a stakeholder. Everyone has to contribute to the defense and the aggression of the tribe. So you raise the boys and girls the same. They start riding horses when they're toddlers. They all learn to use the bow and arrow, and they can all hunt, defend themselves, and go to war. I just want to point out that the horse combined with archery, that's the great equalizer. If you're on a horse shooting a bow and arrow, a woman can be just as fast and just as deadly as a man.
How about sexuality? There are alternating images of man-hating virgins or lesbians who killed their baby sons. Others, like the lusty Atalanta, considered more traditionally male in that she chose her mates unrepentantly. So where's the truth?
The truth was something that the ancient Greeks certainly sought. Some explanation for how would a society work out if the women were the equals of the men. That would mean that they controlled their own sexuality, their own pregnancies and reproduction. This just flabbergasted the Greeks, so they had a lot of speculation about maybe Amazons met neighboring tribes on a seasonal basis. What did they do with the boys? Well, they gave them away to the fathers.
There's also the legend of Thalestris, if I'm saying her name properly.
Yes, the queen of the Amazons.
Right, and she was meant to have told Alexander Great she wanted to have a child with him. If it were a girl, she'd keep it. If it were a boy, she'd give it to him.
That's right, and scholars have puzzled over that, but it's actually of a piece with this custom of sending out the boys to be raised by a neighboring tribe, by the father's tribe.
Well, we have all these myths about Pompey and Cyrus the Great and Mithridates and Achilles and Hadrian, all combating Amazons, all winning, which I think reveals something about the Athenian male psyche. But similar myths persist in other cultures. There is Zarina, there's Serpot, there's the Maiden of Yue. From Persia to China to North Africa, is there any evidence that women warriors spoken of in these cultures were also real?
Yes, that was one of the biggest surprise discoveries in the Greek mythic script. The Amazons are always doomed to defeat and death at the hands of the great Greek heroes. The images and in the vase paintings and sculptures are very brutal, very violent. It doesn't matter how attractive or admirable those Amazon queens are, they're doomed to death. The Greek males were really hostile to the idea of independent women who might be their equals. They really needed to smash them. That was the wonderful thing that I found about the stories from Egypt, from Persia, from Central Asia. Radically different script. In these stories, the great hero goes out to fight these foreign women, the Amazons of the steppes. They fight. They fall in love because they're so equally matched that no one can win. Hmm. No one wins their duels.
Well, Adrian Mayer, just fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adrian Mayer is a research scholar in classics and history of science at Stanford and author of several books on the ancient world, including The Poison King, The Life and Legend of Mithridates, Rome's Deadliest Enemy. There's more in her new book, The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. You'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about the latest in conspicuous consumption, high-end cell phones for the ultra-rich.
What makes it stand apart? Number one, it's upholstered in extremely expensive kinds of leather, which are made from ostrich or snake or calfskin, in fashionable colors that are designed to appeal to contemporary tastes.
Well, if you're wondering what a handcrafted $10,000 cell phone even looks like, and remember, they can go much higher, we posted photos on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'll be back with more Word of Mouth Sunday at noon on New Hampshire Public Radio.